From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made yesterday in the state of Ohio, where Governor Mike DeWine announced that the state is creating a new weekly lottery. For people who get vaccinated, they will be entered into a drawing for a $1 million prize. Governor DeWine says it's just one way to try to increase vaccine demand among the remaining adults who have chosen so far to not get the vaccine. Other states are trying just about everything, from gift cards to free beer. Some of it's working, some of it is not. Writing for the New York Times today, David Lenhardt examines the state of vaccination efforts. He writes, quote, "It's worth emphasizing that the crisis is not yet over. There are two big COVID problems, both involving vaccination. First, roughly one in three American adults remain skeptical of the vaccine, including many older people who are at the highest risk of severe versions of COVID. In the most recent poll by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 13% of adults said they would definitely not get a shot. 6% said they would do so only if required by their employer, their school, or another group. And 15% said they were waiting to see how the vaccines affected other people first," end quote. The slowdown in vaccination efforts has convinced some leading doctors that our country will not be able to achieve herd immunity, and COVID will become a regular circulating disease, like the flu. But vaccinators are not giving up, and they're working every day with people who are on the fence still. Andy Slavitt is helping lead the Biden administration's vaccination efforts. He said yesterday, quote, "The national COVID-19 test positivity rate in the United States is 3.5%. It was 15% in January. This is an all-time low for the pandemic. This news is nothing but good," end quote. And Slavitt points to another rather amazing number. In January, the states of Hawaii, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, and New Hampshire combined for 203 COVID deaths per day. These are small states, and they nonetheless were seeing huge surges in COVID cases. Those six states now account for the six most vaccinated states in the country. They are all around 70% vaccinated. And the number of combined COVID deaths in those six states has fallen from more than 200 every day to roughly 10 combined. The efforts to provide more options for vaccination will soon include Uber and Lyft. The federal government announced yesterday that starting around Memorial Day and running through the 4th of July, Uber and Lyft will offer free rides to 80,000 vaccination sites across the country. This hour, we welcome members of our community who have been hesitant to get vaccinated. No shaming this hour, no mocking, no condescension, just conversation about where they are in their decision-making process, how they've gotten there or what they're still considering, and what will impact their final calls on this. And our guests include someone who has been administering hundreds of vaccines since January. Dr. Steve Cook is a pediatrician with Golisano Children's Hospital. Do you know exactly how many people you've vaccinated, Dr. Cook?
I have no idea how many I've vaccinated.
Guess. I want to guess.
More than 1,000.
More than 1,000. Thank you for making time, Dr. Cook. It's nice to have you back with us here.
Thank you.
Welcome to August Dunlop, who is here to share about the decision-making process. August, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Tanika Thompson, a research analyst at SUNY Brockport, also here to share her story. Hi, Tanika.
Hi, Evan.
And Tori Cowens is Health Homes Care Manager at Companion Care of Rochester, also here to share her story. Hi, Tori. Thanks for being with us.
Hello.
And this is
Thank you for having me. An
impressive group. We're going to meet Jessica Lewis, who's also part of this group later this hour, and they're all part of the Sigma Gamma Rho sorority. So they have, interesting professional backgrounds. In many cases, they're friends, and their stories sort of overlap in that they've all had their own questions about where we go with this. So, Dr. Cook, just a brief comment from you for open the hour, and then we're going to kind of go person by person, and we'll take calls, we'll take emails as well. Generally, Dr. Cook, when you are vaccinating people, you know, are you hearing any stories? I mean, I know the process has to move fast, but the lines have slowed down, the waits are essentially gone. Are you hearing stories from people who are saying, you know, I didn't know if I was going to do this, or I was nervous, or, you know, something convinced me? How often does that come up?
It does come up often. I've been at this so long, I've seen it in different phases. So early on in December and January, we were, vaccinating healthcare workers, frontline providers who both wanted it and didn't have many questions. And then we had the elderly and more chronically ill. And now we are definitely getting into a more ambivalent group. And maybe not so much in line, but at the table or in the observation area, and we take that time to find out, because I think it's hugely important to find out what people are saying. So yes, we are hearing a lot of things. And just when I think I've heard all the reasons not to, or were hesitant, I hear another. And there's also just baseline fear. I mean, if people have underlying anxiety, social phobia, stuff like that, pre-pandemic, they're not going to want to leave the house. I mean, I had a couple people who were like, I'm just anxious. I'm just afraid. I said, are you afraid of the shot? Are you afraid of the virus? No, I'm just afraid. And I'm like, then you've ran 99% of the marathon, my friend. You're sitting here, and we're going to get this done, and I'm going to help you across the finish line. And we've gotten them done. So even when we think it's, oh, do they have transportation or do they not have enough information? I mean, there's still all kinds of things. And while we've had great success, there is still a lot to do.
Well, let's talk about this. And I'm going to start with Tori. And Tori, I'm just going to give you the floor. Tell us what you think about where you are in the vaccine and where your mind has gone in the recent months on this.
I'm really on the fence. Like, I'm going back and forth, but I'm listening to, I'm wanting people to give me information, wanting them to give me knowledge or understanding as to why I should. Like I said, I personally have had COVID and have fought it, you know, had a lot of breathing issues, and really kind of don't understand why I need to get it at this point in time, because if I've, you know, fought it off, then why is it that I need to get something that is not really going to prevent me from getting it again? And that's where my understanding is kind of a little bit, you know, I'm always willing and open to new knowledge and understanding whether or not this is going to prevent me from getting COVID again, or is this just preventing me from having a really severe case of COVID?
Yeah, all great questions. When did you have COVID, Tori?
This was back in November.
And how was it? Was it a tough case?
It was really tough. I had signs. I couldn't. It was really hard for me to breathe. I was lethargic, extremely lethargic. I couldn't hold my head. I couldn't chew. My taste buds were gone. It was just a severe case of, you know, I had the, you know, flat hot flashes. It was like really severe, at to the point where my doctor was on the verge of admitting me to the hospital because my breathing had gotten extremely bad.
So I think you've got a really good question. 6 months later, you're wondering, look, I've had COVID. I beat COVID. Don't I have antibodies? Do I need a vaccine? And if I do get a vaccine, does that mean that I won't get COVID? Or what does that mean for me? I think these are all great questions. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Cook. Go ahead, Dr. Cook. You might be on mute, Steve.
I'm sorry.
There you go. Yep.
Didn't want it, too much background noise. Thank you for sharing your story, Tori. And it's really important to understand that, you know, we know that there is some protection with getting COVID, but it does not appear to last nearly as long. And it's highly variable by individual. So 3 months is probably our safe window. So 3 months after having COVID, we feel people really should get vaccinated. But honestly, right now, because we have enough vaccine, we say to anyone, if you've had COVID and you've cleared, you know, you cleared isolation and you're having minimal symptoms and you want to get vaccinated, you can get vaccinated now. So the problem is of having COVID and how long you will stay immune, we just don't know and can't predict. And the best information we have is maybe 3 months. So with the vaccine, we know, because we're still continually tracking people in studies and tracking people who voluntarily share information in continued research outside the studies, that antibodies, protective levels of immunity are lasting at least 6 months. So yeah, I can understand maybe in December, January waiting, but at this point now, there's no guarantee you have antibodies or effective antibodies. And it's not even clear with the tests that we can do that we could test you to say, okay, you have antibodies that will be protective, because that actually requires very specific tests. So that's one piece of it. The other part of the vaccine, you know, and nothing's perfect. These vaccines do not prevent disease entirely. They are very effective of keeping people out of the hospital. They're very effective at preventing death. But there still can be asymptomatic disease. People still could get COVID and get a mild case or get it with no symptoms. And we are seeing that a little bit. I mean, not often, but sometimes.
Yeah.
Not often. So that's one of the really key points is, well, I don't need it. I already have it. Well, the reality is that you may have no more protection now. And while you might get a mild case of it, any time the virus can replicate is when you can get mutants. And so a term we like to use is by vaccinating and isolating, you can strangle the virus. We can break the chain of transmission, and then you stop mutations, you know, because it doesn't have anywhere else to go. And, you know, the body eventually fights it off and it gets burned out. That person's in isolation, they clear, and then it's not being shared. So on the individual level, you know, you're still not entirely out of the woods. And then on a community level, you represent an opportunity where you could be positive, minimal symptoms, maybe no symptoms, and spreading it to others and allowing for more mutations, more variants to arise. And again, I'm happy to talk more to you one-on-one off air if you're interested. But
let me just make sure before I turn back to Tori that I'm highlighting the parts that I think are going to impact a lot of listeners who may be thinking the same thing Tori did, which is, hey, I had COVID. So what you're saying, Dr. Cook, is that having COVID and recovering does provide some level of immunity and protection, but so far the best research indicates that it is not as durable. It is not as strong of an immunity as the kind of immunity you get from the vaccination. So it's not exactly the same, and it's not as strong. Could last 3 months, could last 6 months, whereas the vaccine we know is at least lasting 6 months, and there's a lot of indications that I'm seeing from new research indicating that that's a baseline, but the expectation is probably longer with at least some level of protection, and we'll find out if time goes on. And then on the question of if you can still get COVID, I mean, if you're vaccinated against disease, most diseases, you can still get the disease. The chances are much, much less likely, and the chances are vanishingly low that someone like Tori would get a really rough case of COVID that either hospitalizes or challenges you to even breathe. Again, not impossible, but extremely unlikely given the success of these vaccines. Is that all true, Dr. Cook?
That is correct.
Okay. Tori, anything else you want to ask the doctor?
No. I think that I'm thinking and pondering what he said and looking at it in many different variables because, understanding vaccinations and vaccines, because just like you said, you can get a vaccine, but that does not stop you from getting. And I think about it where I've been vaccinated for chickenpox, but I still caught chickenpox. So it's still understanding. So I'm kind of really pondering what the information that you have given to me because it's very simplistic, but very, very detailed. I like that.
Okay. And Dr. Cook, on that subject of, hey, you know, I got a flu vaccine and I still got flu, or I got a chickenpox vaccine and still got chickenpox. What would you say about that?
None of these vaccines are perfect. None of them are 100%. I mean, the things that are really durable, truly strongest durability, we do see with, getting innate measles infections and polio, perhaps. Those vaccines are really helpful, but this is also where herd immunity kicks in. What we want to prevent is COVID becoming a seasonal flu. So if you can choke off COVID where it stops transmitting entirely, then we don't have to look at this becoming a seasonal issue where every year we're going to have to look at boostering. And maybe that is a message that's lost, that it's not that we're just trying to slow things down. We want to eradicate what happened. So SARS-1, people may not remember, when first SARS came out, you only spread disease when you were febrile and sick. So people got identified much quicker, isolated, and we broke the chain of transmission very quickly to the point where it didn't become pandemic. This version now is a disease that spreads before you get symptomatic, and even with mild symptoms, it's unrecognized. That's how it's become so spread. So if you think about it, not that it's the same virus or it gets smarter, but this is how it goes from being something that may have been a more symptomatic disease and spread differently with SARS-1 to now a little sneakier. It's transmitted before you know you have it, and it keeps jumping. So part of the reason of vaccinating herd immunity is to not let this even become a seasonal type of issue.
Let's see what some of our other panelists think. And I also want to let listeners know we are going to set aside time for your calls and emails as well this hour as we talk about, you know, making decisions about vaccines. A lot of good questions about there. August Dunlop, let me turn to August for your thoughts on where you are. Go ahead. Floor is yours.
Sure. So I actually started out with the notion that, nope, I'm not going to get it. It's going to be, you know, it's created too soon. I just did not want to get it. But then when I realized that my mom, because I have family members that are older, and my mom was just like, nope, you can't come over here. I don't know where you've been. And I'm just like, you know what? When this vaccine comes out and I'm able to get it, I'm going to get it. Only because I want to be able to be around my family. My son, he's asthmatic, so I want to make sure that I'm doing my part and making sure that he's safe. So once I was able to get the vaccine, I was right there. And I'm so happy that I did, because it just gives me, it allows me to do the things that I necessarily didn't used to do, but I mean, I'm back to some sort of normalcy. Mm-hmm. I'm still wearing my mask. I'm still doing the things that I'm supposed to do to keep myself safe. But I just feel like I have that added piece of protection. And I can go around my family now. They're all vaccinated. And we can just be normal for just a little bit of time, you know, whether it's a Mother's Day or Easter or whatever. There's some normalcy there.
Is there anything in your mind, whether it was the speed of the creation of this vaccine or otherwise, that still stands out to you that you think, boy, I'm glad I got vaccinated, but, you know, I still wish I understood this or that better?
I mean, yeah, the speed of it. And I have to think, okay, this is not 1915, right? We can move much faster than they did back then. But I still have questions. Like, okay, just like my store said, okay, yeah, I get the vaccine, but can I get it again? Can I actually have it and then not know that I have it because I have the vaccine, but then I can give it to someone else that doesn't have it? Because like I said, I do have a son, and I want to make sure that I keep him safe.
Yeah.
So those are like the questions that I do have. How long will this last? Will I have to get another vaccine, like a booster in 6 months, and do this all over again?
Maybe. I'm assuming we will. I'm gonna add, that's why Dr. Cook is here. Oh man. So let's do two things on this, Dr. Cook. That question of boosters is a really good one. My working assumption, and this is where I'm glad the expert's here, is that eventually we will get boosters, whether it's in 6 months or 12 months or 18 months, whatever the case may be. But I'd love to hear what you think. And then on the subject of transmission, my understanding, Steve, is that if you are vaccinated, the research, and it continues to build, is that it is very unlikely that you're going to carry this disease and spread it in a way that can really hurt somebody because of how low any sort of viral concentration and the protection you get from the vaccine. Again, there's no guarantee in life, but the research seems to be really good that this is not a vaccine where you go, well, you're protected, but look, you can still spread it. I mean, probably not. Very, very likely not. Tell me if that's right or wrong, and take me through those two ideas.
So the idea of the booster is really important, because right now they're looking at the booster more specifically just for variants as opposed to a seasonal flu shot. So the thought with, I know with Pfizer, and this is what I've heard in reporting from Pfizer, and so I'm assuming it's the same with Moderna, they're looking at it to see, you know, sadly, to anticipate, is there another variant? So there's a double variant in India that's emerging, and they're worried about transmission of that. And so it's not so much that we're worried about, does it not work for our current strains, but are we going to have to do a booster just to target these variants? And might we only need them in certain countries, you know, or in certain settings? So if, you know, the UK variant, while widely spread, is adequately covered by the original vaccine, that may be fine. But if you have a country or a contained area where you're seeing a new variant pop out, do we need to then get boosters there to really kind of stop or choke off those variants? So that's one of the key points of how they're looking at the booster. So is it just going to be needed in targeted type of use for variants versus just kind of becoming a seasonal thing? And I've not heard that discussed, which I think is appropriate because we don't know how well we can do with this yet. If we can really push this and get this under control, you have countries like Australia, New Zealand that really can control people coming in and out of, they may not require a booster ever if they can continue to use their type of, the restrictions to access to their country. So it is possible to not have to use that. The key with transmission is we are learning more about that. We are seeing protective effects. With the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine, their initial survey, their initial studies really just targeted the outcome of severe disease and death. So when you hear 95%, 94% for those, it's for severe disease and death. They didn't report data on asymptomatic spread or mild disease. Now they're getting some of that data, and other studies not done by Pfizer or Moderna, but done in other communities. Yale did a very large study. They looked at healthcare workers who got those vaccines and looking at breakthrough cases, and they're seeing very, very low rates. So you're right, we're seeing less of it. Some studies are showing that you may shed, but shed less of the virus. So the less you shed, the less you have of transmitting infection. So it is kind of a moving piece. And it was also one of the first pieces that came out with the J&J vaccine, because the first number people heard was like 75% or 78%. Well, that was because that was an average of all the protective levels. So for severe disease and death, it was 95, 96% effective. But for moderate disease, severe disease, or moderate disease or mild or asymptomatic, it may have only been 50 or 60%. And so when you average, that's where you got the 75. So it is much better to be vaccinated, in short, in terms of cutting down transmission, but it's not 100%. And we are still looking at that. That's why we still have to track this. That's why it's important for people, if they get symptoms and there's a suspicion, to go get seen and get tested. Because if there are breakthrough cases, we want to know, is it a breakthrough because it's just the odds it wasn't covered? Is it breakthrough because it's maybe a new variant? And that's something that, is part of the new model we have to think of looking at symptomatic cases now.
Before we get to Nika in there, we're talking about the decision to get vaccinated or not, and just a good open discussion with Dr. Steve Cook, who's vaccinated probably more than 1,000 people since January, on the subject of just answering questions. And got just a few good questions from the audience about this. Jane in Rochester's got one of them. Go ahead, Jane.
Okay. Hi, Evan.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Okay. I wanted to take the opportunity to ask, because I don't know anybody else to ask right now. I took the Moderna, and I was thinking, when we get around to the boosters, will we need to insist that we get the Moderna again? Or it would not seem very good to jump around to different vaccinations. And so I'm wondering how that is. And I'm not going to hang up because I would like to get an answer. There might be something else on that I'd like to ask.
Okay, hang there, Jane. Yep. So
okay.
Let's start with
sure.
That one. So do you need, in the future, if you need a booster, do you need to make sure it's the same brand, Dr. Cook?
I think that's what we're planning on doing, because we're looking at effectiveness. So say Moderna ends up being great against, North Ireland variant or some crazy variant that comes up, but Pfizer stinks at it. Well, if you got Moderna, you might not need it, but if you got Pfizer, then you might need the booster.
Right.
So it's going to be important to understand that.
Because I don't want Pfizer, and I was wondering, sometimes you get in these situations where people will say, oh, it's really just as good, and that's when I would sort of dig my heels in and say, I'll go somewhere else. But thank you so much for answering that.
Sure. You got it, Jane.
So,
thank you.
Let me add something to that, Jane. So flu shots, there's not one flu shot. There's different manufacturers every year. And so you go to Target, they might have one brand. Your doctor's office may have another. No one's ever asked what flu shot brand they're getting.
I remember there was one year when they said the flu shot would only protect you something like, I'm not sure exactly right, but say 60%.
Sure.
And I said, I'll take it.
Oh, yes.
60% is better than zero.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Right. But thanks again.
Wonderful, Jane. Thank you very much. And to Jane's point on the flu shot, there are years where the flu shot's been in 30 to 40%. And that's still a massively valuable global and societal tool. But it's always a moving target. We don't know if COVID's going to be in that range yet where it moves that much. It does, you know, coronaviruses don't seem to have that much wide range as an influenza virus, but we'll see. But Dr. Cook, just one more point on this. So I absolutely take the point that these different variants may be one brand will be more effective against a variant that becomes dominant versus another. If there isn't that much difference or no difference hardly at all among the brands in the future, even if COVID keeps mutating, could you see a situation where we don't even think about if we got Pfizer or Moderna or J&J or Novavax, we just get vaccinated the way we do with the flu?
I think that's definitely possible. The thing that is newer is the messenger RNA vaccines. So the AstraZeneca and the J&J vaccine use something else called a virus vector, which uses a weakened or non-infectious virus to deliver it versus the messenger RNA vaccine. So there may be recommendations along those lines, like, oh, if you got Pfizer or Moderna, get either one as a booster. That may become the possibility. So it's still important to for us to track that and have that in our medical records and see. Also, for the same reason of, say, you got a flu shot 1 year and then they discover, holy cow, this XYZ manufacturer had a contamination. Now you got to call all these producers and practices that got the vaccine and be like, oh, did you give out this lot number? And you have to track people down. So, you know, it's there for effectiveness. It's there for safety as well, too.
Yeah, I think the transparency and the safety tracking is great. Let me steal one more phone call, and then what we'll do is we'll break. I'll get a final thought from August. We're going to let August go, and then we're going to bring in August's colleague Jessica Lewis to join us in our second half hour. But let me get Brenna, who's been waiting from Rochester. Go ahead, Brenna.
Hi there. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
So here's our situation. So it's my husband and I who live at home, and we have one adult son who's also at home. He has gotten the vaccine. My husband is unable to because reasons. And so I'm in this weird place of, I've just been hesitant to get it. I am like an extremely good masker. I've been following all the protocols and I'm like, okay, well, why do I need to, if I've been doing everything I'm supposed to do and have been safe up until this point, none of us have gotten COVID. We've all been okay. You know, and then the other part of that is I'm seeing more and more places that are going to be requiring it, including the place where I may be teaching in the fall. So I'm just, yeah, part of that is like, I'm just kind of rankling against the, okay, now it's feeling like it's no longer in my control to make my own choices too. So there's that.
Yes. So let me ask you a question before I let Dr. Cook jump in from the medical side. You know, just thinking about, you know, how hard you have worked, and it sounds like you've worked really hard to sort of be protective of yourself and your family and to be safe and to do the right things. That has been, as a society, I mean, people have talked about a war effort. I understand we're not going off and fighting a war, but it has been a big ask for society for a long amount of time. This wasn't 2 months. I mean, we've been going on more than a year here. And right. I admire the work that you've done. But I'm sort of tempted to ask, don't you want to not have to do that, at least to that level, anymore? Don't you want to sort of start to move back to where you were?
I don't, even with the vaccine, I don't think I would be comfortable enough being unmasked out in public. So it's kind of like a, well, I'm going to be masking up. I'm going to be following all the same protocols that I have been. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of where I am, because I know this is not 100%. There's still, you know, there's breakthrough infections, there's, you know, all that stuff. And I'm like, just not feeling great about it.
Okay. Dr. Cook, go ahead.
So, Brenna, I totally appreciate your situation. And again, actually having been at the Dome where we've vaccinated literally over 200,000 people, we have looked at and seen people who have had mild reactions, who have had reactions that aren't related to the vaccine or something else. And I've seen people with anaphylaxis. And so our community, not every community, has worked really hard with the allergy specialists. And the allergy specialists and allergic reaction is the only area that really does represent a contraindication. And so I'll just leave this out there as an option, that the allergy specialists at Rochester General and at University of Rochester can see anyone and have looked at vaccinating and have vaccinated people who have had anaphylactic reactions to the first dose. They have tested people who had potential allergies to components to see. And so, you know, and I don't need to know any more of your family history, but we can get virtually everyone vaccinated. Okay. And so, that's completely fine, but I'm leaving it out there as the medical community has taken extraordinary steps to vaccinate as many people as possible. That said, the benefit of herd immunity is for people who can't get vaccinated. So for you to, you know, so as many people as possible to get vaccinated is how it truly protects those who can't get vaccinated. And so that's kind of one of the really key pieces of doing this. So yes, you can continue to do all these things. It may start to take a toll. And the key is, the thing is that, you know, even with doing these things unvaccinated, your ability to spread and transmit is much greater than if vaccinated. So even if you take all the steps, there still is a potential risk. It's going to be much less with more people around you vaccinated. But if you're vaccinated as well, protecting your loved ones, if you are able to protect them even more. So you're protecting them, and this is an added step to protect them even more, is how I would leave it. Because family situations are very difficult, and I've seen people come into our settings with, you know, very difficult situations, wanting to get vaccinated and having questions and stuff. So the more we can help vaccinate and protect to stop this, the more we can protect those who truly can't. So I would hope that we can just help you in your fight to help protect your loved one.
Anything you want to add before we let you go, Brenna?
Okay. No, like I said, you know, my other issue with, you know, feeling the external pressure of, you know, feeling like, oh, if I want to go to a ball game, if I want to take a flight, mm-hmm. you know, that I have to, mm-hmm. that's just, mm-hmm. that's starting to bug me.
Well, I mean, I think the balance of it is it truly going to become a passport type of things where you have to have a passport, you have to have a vaccine to go places, or if you don't, you have to take added steps. So we had a person mm-hmm. who came in to get vaccinated who was really bothered by the fact that they felt like they had to get vaccinated. And we asked mm-hmm. why, and they said, well, my employer says, if I'm not vaccinated, I have to get tested twice a week. I said, well, this is still your choice. You can still choose to get tested twice a week or more, or you can get vaccinated and that no longer becomes an issue. And it is still a choice to, you know, we have certain choices to a point. And with those choices and options, there are implications. You know, sometimes it's a choice of admission or an active choice. Sometimes it's by omission. So it's not easy, though. I mean, this is not an easy situation. And thank you for helping, you know, explain how people are going through this so we can help understand and try
absolutely.
To help people.
Brenna, good luck to you. Thanks for calling, and I wish you and your family well. You know, I just want to, as we go to break, I just want to mention, you know, Brenna is saying what a lot of people have said, which is that, you know, I'm doing my part to not get infected. I am masking up. We've largely stayed home. And all of that, I mean, I can understand it and relate to it in so many ways. But many people listening right now know somebody. If not yourself, you probably know somebody just as I do. My brother got COVID in March, and he has no idea where he got it. I mean, he's been so careful. Most of any activity he's had to do have been outside, and it was one of the – he's a fit 40-something, a runner, and it was one of the roughest months he's ever had. He said the sickest he's ever been. No idea where he got it. It was before he was vaccine eligible where he lived. So he was shocked to get it because you think – I've done what I'm supposed to do. How did I get it? It's not a moral failing to get COVID. There's a lot of ways that you can get it, even when you are trying to do everything you can. And these variants are more transmissible. That's the cleverness of these diseases. They find ways to become even more transmissible. That's how they stay in business. So they find us. So I'm not saying, Brenna, you're going to get infected at all. I'm just saying, you know, I respect exactly where you are. I just hope that you don't end up in a situation like, you know, my brother or so many others where they go, oh, my gosh, I was so careful. How did I get COVID? So good luck to you, whatever you decide, and all the respect and love to you, Brenna. And when we come back here, we have Tori Cowens, who shared her story, Tanika Thompson. We'll circle back with them before the hour's up to kind of see what their final thoughts are on this. Dr. Steve Cook is with us. He's a pediatrician with Golisano Children's Hospital who has been administering hundreds, if not well over 1,000 vaccines in the last several months. And we're answering your questions. And we'll welcome another guest after this only break. Coming up in our second hour, we examine perhaps the strangest individual symptom of COVID, the loss of smell. Nearly half of COVID patients end up with a loss of smell entirely or a damaged sense of smell, at least for a short time. And for some patients, it appears to be permanent. A local doctor is working with patients trying to help them retrain their senses to smell again. We're talking about anosmia next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to bring in Tanika Thompson and Jessica Lewis, joining their friend Tori Cowens. August Dunlop joined us earlier this hour. And as we talk about their own stories, you know, Jessica Lewis is the one who reached out to me, who had this really interesting group of people who've had these thoughtful, careful conversations. They're not all in exactly the same place, but they're all obviously, you know, trying to make good decisions. And Jessica, you guys are all part of a sorority, is that right?
Yes, we are all members of the Theta Omega Sigma chapter of Sigma Gamma Rho Sorority Incorporated.
And so I'm really grateful that you reached out. And I'll start with you, Jessica, and then I'll ask Tanika for your stories here. So where are you, Jessica? What was your process like when you thought about vaccination?
So I was never against the vaccine. I was like, okay, I'm not opposed to it. You know, I'm willing to get it. And at the time when there was kind of like a phased vaccination process happening, they opened it up to folks 30 and over. And once, you know, that became my turn, I was like, oh my God, I got nervous just because it became real. And so I did have a lot of hesitancy. I had to talk to a lot of people. I even had an opportunity to talk to the CEO where I worked, and I talked to her, and she, you know, kind of put me at ease. And then I finally decided to make my appointment, and I did it.
How do you feel?
I feel great. I mean, it has given me such a sense of security. And so that's something very important to me because I do want to get back to some sense of normalcy.
Yeah. And Jessica, you know, everybody has, you know, different groups of friends who have different ideas. And to the extent that there's any sort of common concern expressed when you're having talks with friends and they say, oh, you got vaccinated, is there like a common question or concern raised to you? Like, are you sure? Because I heard XYZ, or my concern is XYZ. Is there something that's more common than others?
Honestly, I think people are like, okay, great. Like, they're like, good for you if they're feeling hesitant. You know, I think people don't want to feel pressured to get it. People are kind of on both sides of the fence about it. There's so many myths circulating. There's so many, you know, unanswered questions. And I have a few questions, too, so I'm really glad that Dr. Cook is on the line. So I think everyone is just, they're coming from a different vantage point.
Yep.
Concerning the vaccine.
Is there anything that stands out you'd like Dr. Cook to address?
Sure. So my question is, with the tetanus shot, you know, it has a lifespan of 10 years. So why is the COVID vaccine so short?
Because it's only been around for so long. We might learn that this vaccine has a 4 or 5 year protective value. You know, we don't know. That's why we are continually tracking. I mean, this has been the amount of information that's collected through VSafe, through the continued tracking of the original study subjects, through VAERS and other reporting systems is gigantic. And they have their pluses and minuses. You know, VAERS is an open system that anyone can report anything. And many times data is unsubstantiated, unconfirmed, you know, especially severe cases, that information goes in, and depending on its source, it'll get confirmed through CDC and others. But this is still very early in the process, and so that's why we want to vaccinate as much as possible and see. It also depends on the specific organism. So tetanus is a bacteria, not a virus. Although polio and measles are viruses. So, you know, it really does depend on the virus. It's the nature of their transmission, infection, how the body handles them and interacts, how the immune system responds, and is it just one type of immune response like antibodies, or is it antibodies and white blood cells or immune cells that help fight off infection that are part of it? So there's a few more complicated steps to it. And the key is that, you know, we need to get vaccinated and share our data, if we're willing, our information, side effects, responses, stuff like that. But even if we don't, we're still studying and tracking to see, is this something that's going to hold up? I mean, the promising findings around the messenger RNA vaccine is that we might be able to create a single vaccine for influenza using the messenger RNA approach. It's not what we've used. We've used essentially a sampling method. We monitor influenza. I mean, influenza shots, flu shots are a global strategy where you are looking at viruses in the southern hemisphere of the world to predict what's going to hit the next season in the northern hemisphere. And it is a guessing game. And we think it's variant A, B, and D. And so that's what we put in the flu shot. But then if by the time it hits North America, it's A, B, and Q, well, maybe it's only 60, 70% effective. So the messenger RNA actually triggers a number of immune responses, not just antibodies. And so that's why we're getting more optimistic. But we need to track and see how long this immunity can be conferred.
All right. That was a great question. Let me bring in Tanika Thompson, who is a research analyst at SUNY Brockport, for some thoughts on this, too. Tanika, where are you on this process?
So initially, when I became eligible, I wasn't sure if I wanted it, similar to Jessica. But I definitely felt like I wanted to travel, see my elderly parents who live out of state. I definitely feel trapped behind the mask and isolated almost, having limited physical contact. So one of the things I wanted to do was to kind of, since I've gotten the vaccine, I feel more free in that way, like a weight has been lifted. I remember Brenna talking about doing all the right things, and I really felt like I was doing all the right things all the time. And it was just coming to a point where it was exhausting, really, to keep doing that. Mm-hmm. And so once I got vaccinated, even though I still wear my mask and I'm very socially distanced, I don't get too close and all these things, I really felt like a weight had been lifted. The responsibility of being so careful all the time on top of all the other responsibilities I had. So I did go ahead and get vaccinated, and I feel great about it, the decision that I made.
Well, and can you share where your family is on this?
My family is kind of a mixed bag. My husband is not interested in being vaccinated. I have a 20-year-old who's away at college who has had access to the vaccine through her employer, but she has opted to wait as well. My 18-year-old who's going off in the fall, besides her school saying, hey, you really need to be vaccinated if you want to be here on campus in the fall, she wanted to get it just, you know, to have a senior year and kind of be out more with her friends and do some things, even though masked again and socially distanced. And then I have a 10-year-old. So I'm really glad Dr. Cook is here because as a pediatrician, Dr. Cook, she's not eligible just yet. But when she is, I'm kind of hesitant for her because she's been going to school since September and she masks up and they socially distance and they go through all of that, the process. And there have been a couple cases in her class, but those students have gotten it from their parents. She's 10, and there's so many other vaccinations that she's still going through, some coming up for her. HPV, that's an optional one, but I want to get her vaccinated for that for sure. So I don't know, like, if there will be enough research with the, you know, interactions between all of these vaccines that she's taking as a 10-year-old coming up. That's one question I have for the doctor.
Okay, Dr. Cook, let's hit that one first, Tanika. Cook, yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, so thank you for sharing your question. Your 10-year-old, I have a 10-year-old, soon to be 11-year-old, and my two older daughters are 19 and 21, and so they're vaccinated. So, you know, four of the five people in my home are vaccinated, and we're waiting on our youngest. So we're looking forward to it. And people ask questions about vaccines, and we do give more vaccines. The adolescent vaccines, the additional ones we've been giving, we actually have staged back a little. We used to give three shots for HPV. We now can do two because we've seen it to be highly effective. And the reality is we've been doing multiple shots in teens and in young children for years. And the long-term side effects, which long-term in a vaccine is 3 months, of whether it's multiple vaccines or single vaccines, there's, you know, people ask this question, oh, with all these vaccines, they interact, could they be interacting? there is no data that shows that. And so kids tolerate them very well. And when we do these studies for new vaccines, we do them in people who are already getting other vaccines. So we're testing them in those real world settings. So when we're looking at, you know, the lower stages of vaccinating, in general, they've used a two week to a month window of like no other vaccines during that time, mostly to say, are you having a side effect? So if a kid is in a study, a vaccine study for Pfizer, they probably will say, oh, they just had their checkup and they just got, you know, this vaccine. They'll say, well, come back and we'll vaccinate you in a little while, because they want to say, all right, we know we're not going to see side effects from your regular vaccine for 2 months. We want to know if you experience anything that we can tie it to what the test vaccine is. So that's how we are rolling out the first ones. And now as we are looking at more data, what we're seeing is people are tolerating these very well. We'll probably go with a lower dose once we get under 12, just because we know biologically the body responds a little differently. So it is important. It's something we need to look at. But when one thing I heard, and maybe it wasn't a question, but I'd like to address is, oh, the long-term side effects. What's really important to know in a vaccine study, long-term is 3 months. It's not anything past that. It's not cancer. It's not infertility. It's not any of those things.
Hold on, Steve. Hold on, real quick. You said it's not infertility. I've got multiple questions from people. Just wanted to hear you clarify that point. Is there any reason women of childbearing age should be scared to get a vaccine or concerned about a vaccine based on possible future infertility?
No. So plenty of women. So in the studies, they told women not to get pregnant. They got a pregnancy test. They told them to use two forms of birth control, and they called these people regularly. And there were something like 23 women got pregnant in the Pfizer study. So despite all that, and I'm not saying the vaccines cause fertility, but, you know, maybe it was the lockdown. So there's no biologic mechanism for it. People have speculated, and this is where you have a little bit of science. People have said, oh, well, the spike protein, it looks kind of like a protein that you see, you know, on other cells and stuff like that. I've asked a couple specialists about that specific question because it has made the realm in the non-science world as something out there. And they're like, the similarity might be like, this is a dog and this is a rhinoceros. Yeah, they're both animals, but that might be where the similarity ends. And so if there were some similarity with the spike protein and proteins on other cells, we would be seeing lots of infertility issues. We would see lots of, you know, miscarriages. I mean, not a few. I mean, lots in women of childbearing age.
Yeah,
and the reality
is
that there's it's not happening.
Yeah.
We are seeing women who get vaccinated versus women who don't and get COVID carry their pregnancies to term and have a healthier pregnancy, whereas women who aren't getting vaccinated are more likely to actually have a preterm child. If they get sick, they're more likely to they get sicker with COVID, and more like if they're getting sicker with COVID or get COVID and get sick, they're more likely to have a premature baby. So there's just enough science of, oh, these cells look alike, but everything past that is fiction. And so, you know, that's the reality. The long term is the clot. You know, we saw clots come up at, you know, 3 weeks to 2 months. That's about as far out from a vaccine as long term is. And the fact that we detected 6 clots out of 6 million doses shows that we're looking and we're doing surveillance and we're not hiding stuff.
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
How are we hiding thousands of miscarriages and lost pregnancies when we find 6 clots?
Now, real tight here, so I want to squeeze one more. If Tanika wants to follow up with anything else, go ahead, Tanika.
I did have a follow-up, and that's a nice segue with the clots that we're seeing with J&J. So my mother actually passed away from a pulmonary embolism, and it's not the J&J is not something I would recommend for women in my family, especially if they're on something like birth control, because that would even increase their – I mean, this is me talking. I'm not the doctor. But this is my thought process with that. And so I mentioned that my 20-year-old has not had the vaccination yet. And then there's also that's one that – SUNY is pushing, I think, right now. And it's a one and done. You know, they like it for younger kids, but also the younger ones are probably the ones who are on birth control. So Is there anything to that? That, again, this is my thinking, that, you know, birth control elevates your likelihood to get a blood clot, and this J&J, we've seen it. It's not many cases, but we've seen it.
Yeah.
Is that a valid concern?
But 45 seconds, Steve. Yeah, I think the good news is there's a lot of options beyond J&J out there right now. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah. So J&J is pushed because it's one and done, but there are other options for your daughter. The chance of getting a blood clot while being on birth control is about 1 in 500. So your chance of getting a clot is far, 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 far greater being on birth control than getting the J&J. The females that they did discover it in, there were only a few of them who were on birth control. Only one was pregnant. So the typical mechanism we see, or, you know, we didn't really see in these cases. So even in women of childbearing age, the risk is maybe 1 in 500,000. Which is about the same as getting struck by lightning.
But if you want to get it to zero, there's other options, you know.
And that's the thing. There are other options. So have her take another option.
I just want to thank everyone. I mean, boy, this hour has vanished. So many great questions. Nick from Webster was asking if COVID and getting the vaccine causes the same symptoms. Nick, I got no symptoms from my COVID vaccine. You often hear people on social media who do because it's it's rougher for 24 hours. But that's it. And that's a big difference between weeks or months or perhaps permanently. So I just want to thank our guests. Tanika, good luck to you. Really great questions. Thanks for taking time to be with us.
Thank you.
Tori Collins, I really appreciate your story. Best of luck to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jessica Lewis, you're the best. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Evan.
CEO of Lulu Public Relations and the creator of Single Dope Black Chick. She's the best. Dr. Cook, thank you, sir. Great work.
Thank you.
We'll do it again soon. More connections coming up.